Osho Talk. Zen, The Path of Paradox, Volume 1, Number 2.
The first question. There is an old tradition that links wisdom and foolishness. Is a wise man simple-minded? Is the simplification that comes with age wisdom or fatigue? What is the difference between a wise man and a fool? The tradition is right. There is a synthesis which goes higher than wisdom itself, where foolishness and wisdom disappear into one unity. It goes beyond foolishness too. Foolishness and wisdom is a duality. Like all other dualities, man and woman, day and night, summer and winter, life and death. All dualities have to be transcended. Unless dualities are transcended, you never come to know the one, the real, the universal. Yes, in that sense, a wise man is a fool too. Because in that transcendence, both are included. But he is not a fool in the ordinary sense. He is not even wise in the ordinary sense. His wisdom is quite a separate reality, so is his foolishness. He is wise because he knows. And he is a fool because he knows that the mystery of life is such it cannot be known. He is wise because his journey is finished. And he is a fool because he now knows for the first time that there is nothing to know and there is no possibility to know. That ignorance is ultimate. He has come to know that ignorance is ultimate. There is no way to demystify existence. We call a man wise who has got the answer. The real wise man has not got the answer. His questions have disappeared. So have disappeared all the answers. He is in a tremendous emptiness. He does not know in the sense of knowledge. We call a man foolish because he lacks knowledge. We call a man knowledgeable, wise, because he is full of knowledge. The real wise man has come to see that there is no way to know the real. The real is there. You can live it, you can be it, but there is no way to know it. Knowledge presupposes division. The division between the knower and the known. Knowledge presupposes distinction. Knowledge is based in duality. A really wise man has come to the point where he is no more separate, where he is no more an island, where he has disappeared into the whole. He pulsates with the whole, he vibrates with the whole. He is no more, only God is. This is the meaning of the Upanishadic seer when he declares, Aham Brahmasmi, I am God. This is the meaning when Christ goes on saying, I and my Father are one. When you look at existence as an object, you remain separate. When you participate with existence, when you become a participant, not looking at an object, but it becomes your very subjectivity, then there is no knowledge. And there is no ignorance either. Because now there is no knowledge, how there can be ignorance? Ignorance and knowledge are aspects of the same coin. And the wise man has thrown both. So a wise man is neither and both. There is an old tradition that links wisdom and foolishness. That is true. There is a tradition that says that Jesus was a fool, and he was. There is a tradition that says that Saint Francis was a fool, and he was. In India, the name of Buddha has taken a form, a very strange form. It has become Buddha. It means the fool. The very name. It means the most wise. It has taken another form, the polar opposite. It has become Buddha. From Buddha. It means the fool, the utter fool. Yes, polarities meet. That's what I was talking about yesterday. What scientists call androgyny. Each man is both. You can become identified with one part of your being. For example, you think you are a man. And there is a woman also inside you, waiting to be recognized, received, accepted. And you go on denying it. You say, I am a man. You will remain lopsided. You are a woman, there is a man also waiting within you. You go on denying the man. Then you will never be one whole. You will always remain split. There is a point of awareness, understanding, vision, where your man and women inside meet and mingle and disappear into each other. That's what William Blake has called the inner marriage. When you have become both, androgynous, man and woman both. In India, we have the perfect symbol for it. Ardhanarishwar. There are statues of Shiva. Half of his body is man and half of his body is woman. He is both the lover and the beloved. The yin and yang. He is androgynous. This same kind of meeting of the opposites goes on happening in many directions and many dimensions. Foolish and wisdom too are your two polarities. If you are wise and you deny your foolishness, you are not fully wise because a part of you has not been yet absorbed. A part of you is hanging around you. It has not yet become an integral part of you. If you are a fool and you think I am a fool, then your wise man inside you is denied, suppressed. A wise man is both, and yet neither. Because he transcends both. So you can say he is neither, but because in him the dualities have disappeared and have come to become a new synthesis, you can call him both too. Is a wise man simple-minded? No. A wise man is no-minded. not simple-minded, not complex-minded. Again, the same duality, the complex mind and the simple mind. A wise man is a no mind. The wise man has come beyond the confine of the mind. He knows no mind at all, because mind divides. Mind is the barrier between you and existence. Mind exists like a China wall. It is your armor. A wise man has no armor. He is unprotected. He is vulnerable. He is open. He is not in any way defending against nature. He is available. He is ready to go with it the whole way. He does not push the river. He flows with it. He need not have any mind. The mind of the whole is enough. He need not have a private mind of his own, because he has no private goal. He is not going anywhere. He is not an achiever. He has no ambition. That's what I mean when I say he has no private goal. So what is the need of having a private mind? The universal mind is enough. So either call it no mind, or call it mind with a capital M. Zen people do both. Sometimes they call it no mind if they simply want to deny the mind that you have. And sometimes they call it universal mind, cosmic mind, mind with a capital M, when they want to say its positivity. What exactly it is? When we call it no mind, we are simply saying it is not what you have got. When we call it universal, cosmic mind, we are showing exactly what it is. Calling it no mind says something negative about it. It is not the mind that you are acquainted with. Calling it mind, great mind, indicates its nature. A wise man is no-minded, or a wise man is a cosmic mind. Yes, he is simple like a child, but he is not a simpleton. He is simple like a child, but he is not childish, remember. There is a vast difference between being childish and being childlike. When Jesus says, only those who are like small children will be able to enter into my kingdom of God, he is talking about the simplicity, the innocence of childhood. But he is not talking about childishness. He is not talking about immaturity. A wise man is not childish. Of course, he is like a child. He is not complex in the sense a philosopher, a logician, a theologian is complex. He is not complex in the sense that he has so many doctrines and ideologies, and he goes on spinning theories. He is not complex in that sense. His mind is at rest. There is no crowd. His mind is empty. He need not think. Thinking is a substitute. When you don't know, you think. When you know, what is the point of thinking? You know it already. Thinking is a state of blindness. If you are sitting here and you are blind, then you will have to think, where is the door? You will have to inquire other people, where is the door? I want to go to the outside. You will be afraid to stumble. You will be afraid to knock against the wall. And she will become worried, where is the door? But a man who has eyes, he does not inquire. He knows the door, he can see it. He does not think about it. The question is irrelevant, where is the door? Because he sees it. A wise man has eyes. He can see. So there is no need to think. Only blind people think. In the West, the idea of a thinker is utterly different than the Eastern idea of the seer. You must have seen Rodin's statue of the thinker or some picture of it, a photograph. We don't call it a thinker. That Rodin's thinker seems to be ill, worried. Yes, you can even look into this statue and you can see millions of thoughts rushing in his mind. A rush hour traffic. You can even see on the marble statue the way he is sitting. His head in his hands. The lines of worry on his forehead. One can almost feel that if this man continues in the same posture, he will go mad. The concept of a seer is totally different. That's why we call him a seer. A Buddha is a seer, not a thinker. A Mahavir is a seer, not a thinker. So is Jesus, a seer, not a thinker. And these Zen people are seers. Why? We call them seers. They can see. When you can see, there is no need to think. For what to think when you can see? When eyes are available, thinking is dropped. Thinking is like the stick of a blind man. The blind man carries a stick to grope his way. There is a parable. A blind man came to Jesus. He touched the blind man's eyes and he was cured. And he was carrying a big stick. He had carried it his whole life. He thanked Jesus. And when he started going away to his home, very, very happy, he has attained to eyes. For the first time he has seen colors and the sun and the sunlight and the flowers and people and faces. He was thrilled. But he is still carrying his stick. And Jesus calls him and says, "Sir, why don't you throw your stick now? Why you are carrying it?" And he says, "To throw it? How can I throw it? I cannot live without it." Old habit. He does not know that now he has got eyes. There is no need for this stick to carry. This happens when for the first time you come in tune with no mind. Still you continue to think. Just an old blind man's habit. By and by you become aware that now there is no point. You are simply repeating an old rut. Thinking becomes irrelevant. That is the meaning when I say a wise man is simple, but not a simpleton. He has all available to him. How can he be a simpleton? His consciousness has expanded. His consciousness has become divine. He is as rich as God Himself. So don't think that He is a simpleton. His richness is far more than the richness of a thinker. Infinitely more. Million times more. But still He is simple. His innocence remains uncontaminated. His source of consciousness remains unclouded. And you ask, is the simplification that comes with age wisdom or fatigue? That which comes with age is fatigue. Wisdom has nothing to do with age. A young man can become wise, and you can find as many old fools as you want. You try to find one and you will find 1,000. Old age has nothing to do with wisdom. Yes, an old man is more experienced, but that doesn't make him wise. An old man is more knowledgeable, but that does not make him wise. He remains as foolish as ever. Because foolishness or wisdom are not a question of quantity. It is not that the foolish knows less and the wise knows more. No. It is a total shift. It is a new gestalt altogether. The ignorant, the so-called foolish person and the so-called knowledgeable person exist in the same dimension. The difference is quantitative, not qualitative. Maybe the foolish person knows only few things and the knowledgeable man knows many things. But the difference is between few and many. The difference is not of quality, it is only of quantity. The difference is of only degree. A wise man is no more on the same wavelength. He has moved into another wavelength. The difference between a wise man and a fool is so tremendous, it cannot be called quantitative. And the difference between a wise man and the fool is exactly the same as the difference between a wise man and the knowledgeable man. He is as far removed from the knowledgeable as he is far removed from the ignorant. He is as far removed from the educated as he is removed from the uneducated. It is a totally new gestalt. His quality of consciousness has changed. Not that he knows more, but that he is more. Listen to it. Not that he knows more, but that he is more. His being is more. It is possible you may be knowing more than Jesus. In fact, it is absolutely certain. You know more than Jesus. You know more than Buddha. If Buddha comes and suddenly had to pass an examination like a bachelor's degree or a postgraduate degree, he is bound to fail. Many who will pass will not be more wise than him. He will not know 1,001 things. If you ask him what is quantum, he will not know. If you ask him, what is this theory of relativity that Albert Einstein has propounded, he will not know. But that does not make him unwise. The difference between you and Buddha is of quality. His presence is different. His awareness is different. His compassion is different. Not that he knows much. Even in those when Buddha was alive, there were many people who knew more than him. Great scholars were there. Great pandits were there. And they used to come to quarrel with him, to argue with him. But those days were beautiful. People were not so arrogant. They could see, even scholars, which is almost an impossibility, even scholars could see that this man is totally different. He exists on a different wavelength. And they will surrender to him. Not that they knew less than him, they knew more. But this man was more. It is not a question that he has accumulated more information. Something has become transformed in him. There is no darkness in his being. It is full of light. That is the meaning of enlightenment. he has attained to light. This light is wisdom. How this light can come just by age? Sometimes it has happened to children. About Lao Tzu it is said that he was born enlightened. The story is that he was born old. He was born so old that he was almost 82 years. And his hair were pure white, snow white. And he had a beard. This beautiful story. It is not true. It is not factual. It is a metaphor. It says he was as wise as a man should be by the time he reaches 82 years of age. Shankara in India died when he was 33. Almost very near to the hippie age limit. 30. Not gone very far. But he was one of the most enlightened persons in the world. Even very, very old sages used to come to sit in his feet. They were converted by him. When Jesus was crucified, he was also 33. Cannot be very much experienced. Cannot be very much knowledgeable. There were many Jewish rabbis who knew more, who could have quoted scriptures far more authentically. Jesus was almost uneducated, a carpenter's son. You cannot expect much. But what was the difference? The difference was not in the information, the difference was in the being. He was full of light, full of joy, full of bliss. He had the aroma of being arrived. Nowhere to go. Nothing to achieve anymore. All desires have disappeared. When becoming disappears, you are a being. And a wise man attains to being. An unwise man goes on after becoming. Become this, become that. Be rich, be powerful. This and that. A wise man is simply happy the way he is. The place he is, the time he is. He has no hankering, not even for God, not even for enlightenment. He hankers not. Desires have disappeared. Desires have left him. This non-desiring state of consciousness is what we call wisdom. No, wisdom has nothing to do with age. With age comes fatigue. Yes, many old people start talking in terms of knowledgeability. They start preaching young people. They start saying things they have never done themselves. Fatigue, tired, and in a very deep way, jealous. If you see a young boy climbing up a tree, don't you feel jealous? And immediately your jealousy is asserted. In a very great advice, you tell to the boy, don't go up, you may fall down. Listen to me. Listen to age. Deep down, look, you are feeling jealous. Those days are gone. You cannot climb the tree. And this boy is doing. When an old man sees a young man and a young woman hand in hand moving with a great vibe of love around them, he feels jealous. Now, she cannot do it anymore. She would like to do it. But the jealousy takes a very beautiful form. It says it is all foolishness. It is just momentary. Listen, says the old man, it will disappear sooner or later. Don't be befooled by it. Don't think that he has become wise. If he has really become wise, he will understand the young people. He will not be against it. A real wisdom is never against life. A real wisdom is always a yes for life. It is never a no. Wherever you find the no very, very emphatic, remember, something else is pretending to be wise. And finally, you ask, what is the difference between a wise man and a fool? The wise man knows that he is a fool, and the fool does not know it. The second question, how do you deal with death? I die every moment. I don't accumulate death. So it is not a problem. If you live really, death is not the problem at all. You need not deal with it. It exists not. Death is a created problem. Try to understand it. Because you don't allow the past to die, it goes on accumulating. It becomes heavy on you. It is a dead load. If you allow the past to die, each moment as the time passes, you let it die. You get finished with it. Each moment you are born again. You don't accumulate the dead past. So you don't accumulate death. And there is no problem to tackle. There is no problem to deal with. You become every moment so fresh. And then you know this freshness is eternal, timeless. Even when the so-called death will be happening, you will not be dying. In that moment, the life has become past, so you don't cling to it. You have learned one thing in life, not to cling. So you don't cling to it. So the problem does not arise. If you cling with life, then the fear of death. The clinging to life creates the problem. And why do you cling with life? You cling with life because you don't know how to live it. You have never been told how to live it. You have been really completely damaged. You have conditioned in such a way that you don't live it. You don't live life. Hence the fear. You never go into anything totally. You don't love totally. You don't cry totally. You don't laugh totally. You have forgotten the language of totality. You don't know what totality means in fact. You are always partial. Even while in love, you don't go to the very end. You don't allow it to happen. You go on resisting. First, you go on accumulating the dead past. That is accumulating death around you. That frozen past is going to become more and more heavy every day because it is growing every day. And your life is very delicate and vulnerable. With that dead past, on top of it you are crushing it. And then that dead past won't allow you to live any moment totally. It always pulls you back. You want to go ahead, it pulls you back. Even if you go, you don't go the whole way. So nothing is fulfilled. Nothing is ever fulfilled. You have not loved ever. You have not laughed ever. Yes, you have laughed many times. But the laughter has never been total. It is always partial, fragmentary. So you are still not aware what life is. You have not yet danced that dance. You have not yet sung that song. When you live life in its totality, moment to moment, you don't feel afraid of death. There is nothing to be afraid. You have lived your life. You have enjoyed this blessing. You feel grateful. Death will start appearing like a great rest, nothing else. Death will not be able to take anything from you, because whatsoever can be taken, you have dropped it before death comes. You have never accumulated it. And death will not destroy anything, because you know how to live each moment totally. When death comes, you will live death also totally. When Socrates was dying, and he is being poisoned, his disciples are crying and weeping. And he opens his eyes, and he says, "What are you doing? Why you are crying? In such a beautiful moment, what are you doing? Why you are missing? Participate with me. Death is happening. Don't miss this opportunity. Try to see death. That's what I am doing." And he goes on saying to his disciples, "Now my legs have gone numb. But it is mysterious. My legs have gone numb. I cannot feel my legs anymore. But my feeling about myself is still the same. It is not less." Then he says, "My hands are going numb." And then he says, "They have disappeared. I cannot feel." He says to one of his disciples to pinch. He is pinched, but he cannot feel. And he laughs. And he says, "This is strange. Now my body is almost dead. But I am as alive as ever. My feeling of consciousness is as total as ever." Then he starts feeling his heart is sinking. And to the very last moment he says, "Remember, this is my last saying. I will not be able to say anything more because my tongue is getting frozen. This is the last thing," he says to his disciples, "that I am as totally alive as ever, that my consciousness is not a bit less. So the body cannot destroy me. The body is gone. I am on the verge to disappear. But my inner feeling, my feeling of my subjectivity is as untouched as ever. In fact, it is more clear than ever. Because death gives a context. It becomes a blackboard. And life becomes something written by a white chalk on the blackboard. In life, you may not be able to feel life so keenly, so acutely, so sensitively. But in death, because of the contrast, just like in the night, you see the stars. And when the night is dark, the stars are more shining. In the day, they are there. They have not gone anywhere. They cannot go anywhere. Where they can go? They are there. But because of the sunlight, you cannot see them. Their light is lost in sunlight. In the dark night, they are there. So beautiful, twinkling. Exactly the same happens in death. Life becomes a star, shining so luminous. You ask me, how do you deal with death? I don't know what death is, because I go on dying. Each moment I go on dying to the past. I don't live in the past. Because I don't live in the past, I don't live in the future. Future is always a projection of the past. A dead past creates a false future. And only this moment is true. I am here. Just now, feel this moment. Where is the problem of death? How can you die in this moment? Death is always a projected problem. Someday you will die. It is just an inference. Someday. Somebody has died. You have seen a person dying. And then you become afraid, I am going to die. But have you really seen that he has died? You have seen only his outward expression of death. You don't know what has happened to him inside. Nobody has ever died. Death is the greatest untruth. It exists not. Only life exists. It is eternal life. Drop the past, and then the future is dropped. And in the present there is no death. In the present there is only life. Listen to this beautiful story. The college psychology class was studying human reaction to sexual stimulus. And of special interest was the frequency of amorous relations. How many students here, said the professor, engage more than once a week? 5 people raised their hands. And how many engage once a week? 10 hands went up. How many twice a month? 8 hands went up. Once a month, 4 hands were raised. And how many once a year? A little guy in the back waved his hand frantically and giggled hysterically. If you engage only once a year, said the professor, I don't see what you are so overjoyed about. Flushed with excitement, the little guy said, but tonight is the night. Let this moment be the moment. Don't live in the past, because nobody can live in the past. It is no more. And don't make your palaces in the future. It cannot be done. The future exists not. Live in this moment. Jesus says to his disciples, look, those lilies in the fields, how beautiful they are. Even Solomon was not so beautiful, attired in all his costly garments. And what is the secret of the lilies in the fields? They live in the moment. Today is the day. Tonight is the night. And this moment is the only moment. Once you start living in the moment, you are constantly in touch with life. And life refreshes you. Life goes on rejuvenating you. Yes, the body will disappear one day. But that is not death. It is simply a tired body goes to rest. Yes, this mind will be lost, because this mind has been used. What do you want? Do you want to use the same mind forever and ever? Are you not fed up with it? This mind works the day you are born. It starts working up to the day you die, 70, 80, 90 years. It is a mechanism. Feel little compassion for the mechanism. By and by it gets old. By and by it does not function so well. You need a new mechanism. This body becomes old. This body becomes rotten. This is a mechanism. A tremendously intricate and complex mechanism. Nothing like it science has been able to invent yet. So automatic. You think automation is new? Your body has been automatic for millions of years. You eat food and automatically it is digested. You don't have to digest it. You breathe in and automatically the blood takes the oxygen, releases carbon dioxide. You don't have to do these things. Just think if you have to do these things. You will go crazy within one day. You will not be able to survive. It is all automatic. 70, 80, 90 years of this mechanism functioning so perfectly well. Yes, sometimes you feel ill, sometimes you are not good and this and that, but that is nothing. With such a complex and delicate mechanism, all illnesses are nothing. It is a miracle that you exist at all. It is a miracle that sometimes you are healthy. But all mechanisms get tired. Even metals get tired. Now scientists say that metals get tired. While I am speaking, not only my body will be tired, this microphone. Everything gets tired and everything needs rest. Death is just rest and nothing else. You dissolve into the elements. The body goes back to the earth to rest. It will be revived again in 1001 bodies. It will come back again. Can't you watch it everywhere? Spring comes and the trees are full of bloom. And then flowers disappear back into the earth. Then leaves fall down back into the earth. They become manure. Again they will enter into some other tree's circulation. Again they will become part of some other tree. Again they will live under the sun. Again they will enjoy the winds and the moon and the stars. And again they will laugh, and again they will smile, and again they will sing a song, and again birds will come. And people will be overjoyed seeing them. This goes on. Life is a continuous circle of action and rest. Action and rest. Life is not only that which you call life. Death is part of life. Death is not the end of life. Death is part of life. In fact, it is through death that life exists. Because through death, life goes to rest. And again, becomes full of energy and vitality and comes back. It is like going to sleep in the night. Yes, sleep is a mini death. You die for a few hours. If you die rightly in the sleep, the morning is very fresh. You are again young. Again your eyes have a sparkle to them. Your feet have a dance to them. Again you are full of joy and juice. If you have not been able to sleep well, the morning is tired.
So learn to live well and learn to die well. When you die, die utterly. So that when you are born again, again the juices are flowing. And why be bothered about it? You are not bothered about one thing. Have you ever speculated about it? Have you ever thought where you were before this life, before this birth? You don't care. Why? Then why you are caring about death? Many times you have passed through death. But you don't care anymore. You may have been the great Alexander. Who knows? All kinds of mad people are here. You may have been Genghis Khan or Adolf Hitler. So many Germans are here. Who knows? All kinds of things happen in this world. But you are not worried. Even if somebody says that you were Alexander the Great, you will say, I don't care. What does it matter? But when you were Alexander the Great, it had mattered much. You were thinking too much about death. You will die. But yet, you will not die. Just the combination. This body gets tired. This mind gets tired. This ego gets tired. And that which is real inside this, the real master of your house, consciousness, takes a jump, tries to find another body, another womb, and goes on. A moment comes when you get tired of these circles of life itself. First you get tired of one circle, then you enter into another, then another, then another. Wheel upon wheels. One moment comes in your life when you become more and more alert what is happening. You get tired. Not only of one life, but life as such. This constant coming, going. What Hindus call avagaman. Coming, going. The day you become tired of this very coming and going, you become religious. Then a new element has entered into your consciousness, a new ray of light. Then you start thinking of nirvana. Nirvana is ordinary death is getting rid of one life so that you can live again. Nirvana is getting rid of all lives. So you don't live as an individual. You start living as the universal. You start living as God. Then there is no need to come back to the body, to mind, to ego. The third question. One philosopher said, knowledge is a virtue in the second half of life, but the bore in the first. Should not sadhana be reserved for those over 40? Knowledge is always a bore. It is not that knowledge is a bore while you are young. Knowledge is always a bore. Knowledge is rubbish. Knowledge is not the real thing. How it can be otherwise? It has to be a bore. It is not the real thing. It is as if somebody is hungry and you go on talking about recipes and foods and this and that. and somebody is hungry. People need knowing, not knowledge. People need understanding, not knowledge. People need wisdom, not knowledge. Knowledge is a bore. It does not matter how old you are. And the second thing, religion has nothing to do with age. Sometimes it can happen when you are young. Sometimes it may not happen when you are young. It depends on 1001 things. Sometimes a man is so alert that while he is young, he becomes aware of the falsity of the world. And sometimes it happens a man has become old and he has not yet become alert of the falsity of the world. People are not alike. They are very different. So there cannot be no fixed and fast rule. But as a general statement, it can be said that people start becoming religious near about 42. Don't take it as a fixed law. It is not. Higher the entity in existence, less and less fixed laws are applicable. Lower the entity, fixed laws are applicable. You can say water evaporates on 100 degrees. Now it is fixed. Whether it is Tibet or India or Iran does not matter. Water will evaporate at 100 degrees wherever you are. Because the water is yet not individually conscious. It has no freedom. Trees have a little more freedom. And they become a little more unpredictable. Animals have a little more freedom. They become even more unpredictable. Man is the most free agent in this existence. He is very unpredictable. But as a general statement, it can be granted that near about 42, people start thinking of religion. There is a certain natural tendency at that time. A life according to yoga and tantra can be divided into 7 years fragments. A child enters the first change when he is 7. Then his childhood is over. A great change. When he is 14, sex enters into life. Another great change. Now he will have different outlook, different desires. At 21st, ambition enters life. He becomes more political, rebellious, protesting, fighting, ready to fight with anybody. He becomes a revolutionary. At 28, he starts settling. He becomes more interested in comfort, a bank balance, a good salary, a good home, a wife, a child, a TV, a car, things like that. He starts becoming more square. So hippies are right. Don't trust the man who has gone beyond 30. Because after 30, everybody becomes orthodox. It is a natural trend. After 28, a man becomes really a householder. So you don't see hippies, old hippies. No. Near about 28, hippies disappear into this wide world against which they were fighting.
By the time they are 28, they start becoming more traditional, conventional, confirming. That day of revolution is gone. Now they have to settle. They have to make a nest on some tree. They start of thinking of marriage, of children. And naturally, when marriage happens and children, then you cannot be a revolutionary anymore. By the age 35, a man becomes almost established. Whatsoever has happened, he becomes established. If he has succeeded, he becomes established in his success. If he has failed, he becomes established in his failure. Then he knows that now nothing can be done, nothing doing. Whatsoever has happened, has happened. He becomes very, very fatalistic. He starts believing in kismat. He says nothing can be done. Whatsoever was written in my head has happened. Now, he is not in any way ready to fight. He relaxes. By the age 42, he starts becoming a little bit aware that what he is doing here, earning money, power, prestige, and death is coming. Death knocks at the door for the first time near about 42. So that's why, that is the age when you have heart attacks and blood pressure and cancer and things like that. That is the first knock. Beware of the age 42. It is the most dangerous age. Then you start feeling a little shaky. Then you start feeling a little trembling inside. You are no more as certain as you used to be. You lose confidence. You have lived. You have known money. You have known wife, children. You have known sex, love. You have seen this and that. You have traveled around the world. Nothing satisfies. Something feels missing. This is the moment when religion enters in your life. Remember, death and religion enter together. The knock of the death is the knock of religion too. Now it depends on you. If you are very anti-religious, you will miss the opportunity of being a sannyasin when death knocks. If you are very anti-religious, fixed in your attitudes, in your prejudices, then you will have only heart attacks, blood pressures, TB, cancer. Then you cannot have God. This is your choice. But if you are an open person without any prejudices, this moment you start looking for God. If death is there, you start searching for something eternal. Death is coming. Now there is no more time left. You have to look into your life. You have to settle accounts with life. And this life that you have lived up to now suddenly becomes futile, meaningless. But it happens to people in different times. To somebody it may happen at 35. To somebody it may happen at 50. I am talking only of an average. 42 is the limit line. If you are very intelligent, it can happen early. If you are very stupid, it will not happen even at 42. It depends. It is a question of intelligence. Stupid people go on remaining unreligious to the very end. Intelligent people start turning towards religion from the very beginning. Yes, it is a question of intelligence, not the question of age. But age plays a role because a hormonal change starts happening. By the age 40, too. Sex is no more such an obsession. Finished you are with it, unless you are a saint. Then you are in trouble. Unless you have fallen a victim to some Mahatma, then you are in trouble. Then you can go on being obsessed with sex to the very end. More sexual freedom, faster sex becomes meaningless. More experience of sex, and sooner it loses all significance. It becomes very ordinary. Remember this. Avoid Mahatmas, ascetic people. Otherwise they will never allow you to go beyond sex. This will look very strange to you. Listen to me. These are the people who have kept sex alive on the earth. If people like me are allowed to have their say, sex will soon disappear from the earth. It will remain very biological. It will lose all romance. It will lose all nonsense that you go on putting in it. That nonsense arises out of repression. If you repress sex, then even at the age 42, you will not feel that sex is meaningless. In fact, the more you repress it, the more sex will attack you. With vengeance, it will come back again and again and again. It will haunt you in your dreams. It will haunt you in your fantasies. That's why you read in the old scriptures always the same story. A great seer is sitting under a tree, and apsaras come from heaven. Beautiful women with golden bodies, and dance naked around him. Now why? And this poor old chap, he has not done anything wrong to anybody. He is sitting under his tree, doing his japa, turning his beads. He has left the world. Now why heaven is so much interested in this poor man? And why disturb him? But this happens in every age. This happens to Hindus, this happens to Christians, this happens to Jainas, this happens to Buddhists. This seems to be a very, very universal phenomenon. Why it happens? And these people go on interpreting it as if devil is trying to distract. Nobody is trying to distract. It is your repressed sexuality that is coming with vengeance. When you repress sexuality, it drives you crazy. These so-called seers sitting under their trees and their caves in the Himalayas are simply getting neurotic. They need psychiatric treatment. They don't need anything else. They need the psychiatrist's coach. They should go to some Freud, to some Jung, to some Adler. They should go into their dreams. They should be analyzed. If you don't repress sex, sex loses meaning in its own time. As it becomes very, very meaningful at the age 14, it becomes very, very meaningless at the age 42. Remember two things. When death knocks at the door, when death starts entering, sex starts going out. They are related. Sex is birth. Death and sex are the enemies. They cannot exist together. When death starts coming, sex starts moving out. They cannot live in the same house together. But one thing is very, very essential to understand. Sex goes only if you have lived it utterly. If you have known it. if you have experienced it, if you have not repressed in any way, if you have been very, very expressive, then it dies a simple death on its own accord. If you repress it, then it clings. Any unlived desire clings. Any unlived thing goes on hanging around you. At the age 49, again a great change happens. A man is not only interested in something greater than sex, he becomes involved, committed. At the age 42, he starts thinking, brooding, contemplating. But at the age 49, he starts being committed. He can become a sannyasin. He can become a bhikkhu. He can become a monk. Or he may not take any outward form. He may start changing in his inside world. He will become a meditator, certainly. He will start praying. And this will be a commitment. Now, this will not be a feeling, a just feeling. He will devote his whole life to it. Devotion arises at the age 49. Commitment arises at the age 49. And if things go right, and you are not distracted by foolish people all around, by the age 56, your meditation will start flowering. First satoris, first glimpses of God. And at the age 63, you will have established into samadhi. You would have become enlightened if things go rightly. And then you can live at least 7 years. If you were going to 70, I have divided according to 70. You can live 7 years a divine life, imparting divinity to others. You can become a master. This should be the right process. Up to 42, somehow it goes okay. Because up to 42, everything is in the world. Beyond 42, things start going wrong. Because beyond 42, you start moving beyond the world. And all the commitments and involvements and all the investments that you have done up to 42 become a barrier. For example, you loved a woman. You got married. Now suddenly you start becoming a meditator and the woman is against it because she feels afraid. And rightly so. She feels afraid if you become a meditator, you will lose interest in her. And she is right. Now she will disturb. She will be against you. She will not allow you to become a sannyasin. She will say, no. Think of me. Think of my children. What has happened to you? Have you gone mad? Then why in the first place you got married to me? And why you have given birth to these children if you were going to become a sannyasin? That's why I say there is no need to leave the children and no need to leave the wife. Be with them and yet you can be a sannyasin. Sannyasin is an inward journey, but the wife will create trouble. The husband will create trouble. Because a new interest is coming into your life which has never been there before. Naturally, this new interest will change your whole pattern. You will not be the same man again. If your wife comes and becomes interested in me, you are disturbed. If you come, your wife becomes disturbed. Because a new interest is arising. And who knows where it will lead, where it will lend you. Fear, jealousy, defense, struggle, egos feel hurt. You have been earning money. You have made a great kingdom, you have made a big empire. Now suddenly at 42 you start meditating. Now your whole empire will be against you. So sudden a change, and all changes are sudden. Up to 42 the changes were within the world, so there is no problem. But beyond 42 the changes are higher than the world. They start moving towards God, closer to God. You are going back home. It is a return journey. This world is finished. You ask, one philosopher said, knowledge is a virtue in the second half of life, but a bore in the first. Knowledge is always a bore, but wisdom. Yes. Wisdom is a virtue. And wisdom is a virtue all over your life. It is never a bore. I have never seen a man bored with wisdom. If you are around a wise man, you will never be bored. In fact, you will be surprised how it is that you are not bored. A wise man is so fresh. He goes on pouring his freshness in you. He is so young. He may be old, but still he is so young because his consciousness is so young. He goes on flowering in new ways. He does not carry the dust of the past. He is always fresh. His mirror is clean, and you can always look at your face growing. You can always look into him, and he will always find nourishment through him. Wisdom is never boring. Wisdom is nourishment, but knowledge is boring. Knowledge immediately creates boredom because it is false, it is dull. It is borrowed. It is dead. Have you seen a small child playing around you? You are not bored with him. He is so alive. So buoyant. Dancing, singing, running. You start feeling young with him. And have you sat with an old man? He may not do anything. Must be just sitting there reading his newspaper. And you start feeling bored. He has not said a single word. Just his very being is heavy. Knowledge is heavy. Wisdom is light. The fourth question. All you said this morning is included in the gospel. So why do you reject in front of us Jesus and the gospel instead of saying how total they are, but that the message has been killed by man, and that for these Christians we should go back to the source, the gospel, or try, if not Christians, the first steps with your approach? A Christian has arrived. If you understand the gospel, then the question will not arise, because whatsoever I have said is included in the gospel, even the denial of the gospel. All real scriptures have denied scriptures. All alive books have been against dead books. If you have understood the gospel, this question will not arise. You don't understand your gospel, and you cannot understand. Because the only way to understand the gospel is to go within words. The gospel cannot be understood directly. You cannot go and read the Bible and understand it. That will give you knowledge, but not insight. That knowledge you must be having. That's why you became troubled. Because whatsoever I have said, even sometimes if I say something against Christ, go to Christ and ask Him. He will approve of it. How I can deny Christ? How He can deny me? It is impossible. Because it is a question of a different consciousness. Christ has nothing to do with Christianity. Just as Buddha has nothing to do with Buddhism. Just as Krishna has nothing to do with Hinduism. These people live in a totally different consciousness. And if you want to understand them, their words won't help you. You will have to go into that world of consciousness. Only then you will understand. You think that we should go to the source, the gospel. The gospel is not the source. The source is within you. If you go to the source within you, you will understand the gospel. Not otherwise, not vice versa. Not that you understand the gospel and then you can go within yourself. No. The way goes through your innermost core. What Jesus is saying to people, the kingdom of God is within you. He is not saying it is in the gospel. He says, look withinwards. The God is there. He is not saying, look heavenwards. He is saying, look withinwards. And exactly that is what Zen is saying. Jesus is a Zen master. Zen is saying, burn the scriptures. Don't feel offended. That is the way how Zen speaks. It is one of the most profound ways to speak. Burn the scriptures. Why? So that you don't have anything to look in the outside. So, the bridge to outside is broken. Then you will have to move inwards. And the day you have reached to your own consciousness, you will see how true Jesus is. Then you become the gospel. You ask, all you said this morning is included in the gospel. Yes. Note this too. That the denial is also included in the gospel. The very denial of the gospel is included in it. Jesus' whole teaching is that God is an experience. Jesus is not a theologian. He is a mystic. But it always happens. All great mystics, when they are gone, are pounded upon by the theologians. I have heard about Michelangelo. He had made a painting of Jesus in a church, and the Pope and few bishops came to see it. And they started criticizing it. They started finding faults with it. And Michelangelo was standing there and listening. And the Pope said, okay, everything is okay, but you have painted Jesus' face too red. And Michelangelo said, yes, sir, I have not painted his face too red. He is feeling very ashamed because of you people. He is ashamed to see to whose hands his words have fallen in. This happens always. This is going to happen to me too. Beware. So why do you reject in front of us? I reject the gospel. I reject Christianity. I sometimes even reject Jesus so that I can bring you to Jesus. Because to come to Jesus, one has to go through total denial. Otherwise, you will go on clinging. Nothing should be left outside you. The scripture, the church, the Christianity, everything should be destroyed. So you are thrown back to yourself. That is the Zen method. But I can understand if you have lived in a certain kind of prejudice. If you are a Hindu, are a Mohammedan, are a Christian, it is very difficult to get rid of it. It is not like clothes that you can drop easily. It is like your skin. It is difficult, it is painful. But without that pain, there is no growth. Reading the scriptures, you remain a second-hand man because your God remains second-hand. A spinster of 40 had a brother at sea, and he sent her a pair of parrots in a double cage. The spinster was intrigued to know which was the cock and which was the hen. As they were exactly alike, so she consulted a vet. "Watch them," said the vet. "The one that gets on top is the male." "I do watch them," said the lady, "but they never do anything." "Then creep down at dawn and have a peep. And when you know which is the cock, be sure and mark it." The spinster obeyed instructions and caught the birds in the very act of mating. Thrilled to bits, she tied a white tape around the cock's neck. The following Sunday, the vicar came to tea. As he removed his coat, the cock parrot shouted, "Hello, so you have been caught doing a woman as well, have you?" All borrowed knowledge is like that. Don't carry a second-hand God. God will never be happy with you. Don't become a carbon copy. God loves the originals. Because God is tremendously original. God does not want more Jesus than one, otherwise he would have created. And God does not want more Buddhas than one, otherwise he would have created. He creates a Buddha only once. He never repeats. So if you really want to attain to God, be yourself. Don't be a Christian, and don't be a Hindu, and don't be a Mohammedan. Be yourself. Be an authentic being, and in being that, you will know what Jesus is. In being that, you will know what Buddha is. In being that, you will know what God is. The last question. I am getting very bored with sex, and that creates anxiety. It seems as if I am losing interest in life itself. And then, what is left there except death? What should I do? You have come to ask a wrong man. You should go to some so-called Mahatma. You can read Mahatma Gandhi's books or Swami Sivananda's books. They will be helpful. They function almost like aphrodisiac. Few suggestions. Don't look at the Playboy magazine. Don't go to a movie. Don't look at women. While you walk, keep Buddha's rule. look only 4 feet on the ground. If you see a woman, escape. Soon you will not be bored with sex. Apsaras will start coming to you. This question must have come from a Westerner, because it never comes from an Indian. Indians are never bored. They cannot be. They have so many Mahatmas. When Indians come to me, their question is how to get rid of sex. Just see how conditioning can make great differences. When a Hindu comes, he is always worried how to get rich. This question must be from an American. Yes, in America there is no future for sex. It is finished. If not, then within 20 years it will be finished utterly. When sex is absolutely accepted, it is bound to become boring. It is a repetition. It is the same thing again and again. And when it is available, you don't fantasize about it. And when it is available too much, by and by you start feeling what you are doing, what nonsense. You start looking a little insane, what you are doing. The thrill, if you really want to keep it forever fresh, evergreen, can be kept only through repression. In all the past ages, east or west, sex was never a boring thing. Never. Because all the religions have taken care of it. They have been preaching anti-sexuality. And through anti-sexuality, they were keeping sex alive. The post-Freudian man is bound to feel one day or other that sex is a boring thing. It is. It is a very mechanical thing. All that you see into it comes out of your repression. It is not there. It is almost like a man who has been fasting. Food becomes a great fantasy when you fast. If you are fasting and you go to the market, you will not see anything else except for the stores, restaurants, hotels. You will not see other things. There are other things also. Millions of things are being sold, but you will see only food everywhere. Food will float everywhere. Henrik Heine has written that once he was lost in a forest, for 3 days he could not find the way, and then came the full moon night, and he was so hungry, and he was a great poet, and he had always written about the moon. He was fascinated by the moon, and he has always compared the moon with his beautiful beloved. That day he was surprised. He saw a white bread floating in the sky. Those beautiful women disappear. He must have rubbed his eyes. What is happening? Have you gone crazy? But nothing is happening. When you see a beautiful woman in the moon, it is also the same thing. You are fasting. Your fast becomes a projection. In the past, the so-called religious people had taken care of sex. The past ages were so much interested in sex. All the scriptures are against it. All the priests are against it. All the popes are against it. They kept it alive, but now it is difficult. And you are asking a wrong man. Listen to few stories.
the honeymooners were at Niagara Falls, where they went immediately to a hotel room and did not leave it for 5 days. On the morning of the 6th day, hubby remarked, "Dearest, would you like to see the 8th wonder of the world?" And his wife replied, "If you take that thing out again, I will scream and call the police." That's what is happening. There is a limit. You are getting bored. You are at the moment when you will scream and call the police. A boy of 12 went to his father with a little girl of 10, a neighbor's daughter. "Dad," he said, "we want to get married." "Yes, son, in 10 years." "No, Dad, now." "What are you going to live on?" "We can manage on her pocket money and mine," said father, playing the joke along. "Ah, I see. And what if she has a baby?" "Well, Dad, nothing has happened so far." From the age 10, even before that, you start. How long you can remain unbored? And all kinds of things have become available in America. Vatsayana's Kama Sutra and pictures and picture books of Khajuraho and Konark and Puri and 1001 ways by creating beautiful bodies, at least the illusion of beautiful bodies through photography, photographic tricks. Pornography has become so important that it is killing your sex desire. Hefner is the enemy of sex desire, and Playboy and all other girlish magazines, they are killing, destroying. And then heterosexual and homosexual and bisexual and 1001 kinds of methods. I have always felt while reading Vatsayana's Kama Sutra, it is one of the great work. I have always felt that in the days of Vatsayana, India must have been in the same mind as America today. People must have got bored. Otherwise, who invents so many sex postures? Why? One posture has been always enough. And Vatsayana goes on inventing. This seems people must have become very bored. Then something you have to invent. This inventiveness simply shows boredom. Vatsayana must have been helping people. He was a great seer, a great wise man. He must have looked at people's misery. They were getting so bored. Something had to be done. Whenever a culture becomes too free about sex, it becomes bored. India was one day very, very free, one of the most free countries in the world. When there is freedom, naturally you don't repress. When you don't repress, boredom arises. So many postures were invented. So many ways to try through new channels the same pleasure. You are bored, try it in some other way. Group sex must have been prevalent. There are indications in Khajuraho temples.
When people are getting bored with one man, one woman relationship, they start playing with groups. Wife swapping has become prevalent. These are all signs that sex is dying. Dying out of too much freedom. A young hippie bookseller was arrested by a member of the Vice Squad for peddling pornographic photographs. "But you are making a big mistake," said the hippie. "These are not dirty pictures." The officer selected a particularly intricate study of several naked men and women. "Now you can't tell me that this is not a dirty picture." "Ah, come on, man," shrugged the hippie. "Have not you ever seen five people in love before?" Things like that have become very common. These are signs of boredom. But I will still say you have come to a wrong man. Because I am very happy that you are bored. My whole effort here is to make you bored with sex. Because if you are bored with sex, only then you become interested in God, never otherwise. A repressed person remains interested in sex. That's why I'm against repression. You will be surprised. This is my logic. This is my mathematics. A repressed person remains interested in sex, remains obsessed with sex. So I say, have all sex that you can have. And soon you will be finished. And when you are finished and sex loses all meaning, that will be a great day, a great moment in your life. Then you can become interested in God, never before it. Only a bored man, bored with sex, can become really a celibate, a brahmacharya arises, a pure brahmacharya arises. Out of sheer boredom. If you are not yet bored, then your brahmacharya will be a repression. And I am not in favor of any repression, because repression keeps alive the joy in sex. People think that I teach sex. I am one of the persons who is teaching God. If I talk about sex, there is a reason in it. The reason is, I would like you to know it before it is too late. Know it. Know it totally. Go into it headlong and be finished with it. Go into it meditatively, alert, aware. That is the approach of Tantra. That's the Tantra attitude. Go into it and see. If you know something well, you are free of it. Knowledge, understanding, liberates. To me, you are in a good state of mind. Don't be worried. It is good. You are fortunate. Sex is finished. Now don't go to any Mahatma. Otherwise, it may start again. This is the moment when you can help your energy to move towards God without any hindrance. Now there is no obstruction at all. It is sex energy that becomes samadhi. When sex energy is freed from sexual objects, it starts moving into meditation. It becomes prayer. Yes, Jesus is right when he says God is love. It is your love energy that flowers as God. Once it is freed from men and women, once you are no more interested in men and women, then where your energy will go? It will start moving inwards. Man is outside, the woman is outside. Remaining interested in men and women, you are remain interested in the other. When there is no sex left, the other is finished. Your eyes start closing.
you naturally become silent. But I can understand your anxiety, the American anxiety. You think only sex is life. If sex is finished, then what is left except death? I would like to tell you, God is still left. Sex is finished, God begins. Don't be worried. Don't be anxious. Don't be in anguish. Relax into this state. And don't lose this opportunity, because there is every possibility you may fall into somebody's hands and he may create your sex desire again. Use this opportunity for meditation. It is a great opportunity. A door has opened a little bit. Look through it. Yes, it is the same door from death enters. It is the same door from which sannyas enters. It is the same door from death comes. The same door from God. The same door from which God comes. It is a God-given opportunity. Don't miss it. Enough for today. Thank you.